Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Sister Helen Prejean, whose new book is River of Fire, My Spiritual Journey. Helen Prejean is a member of the Congregation of St. Joseph. She has devoted half of her life to speaking out about the death penalty, writing such best-selling chronicles as Dead Man Walking and The Death of Innocence. In her new book, she writes about her early life as a Louisiana native growing up in a Catholic Cajun family, as a young nun finding her vocation, and as an evolving spirit. Today, we're talking about River of Fire, My Spiritual Journey. Sister Helen, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Susan.
So great to see you. Now, you drew on journals for this book, and you have been keeping a journal for half your life, more than half your life.
Yeah.
So talk about the inspiration for that writing.
I know it exactly. There was an exhibit on John F. Kennedy in New Orleans, and we went and looked. They had pictures of him speaking. They had postcards he sent from camp and doodles and all that he had done. But it was just like his writing as a kid. And then they showed a picture of him giving a speech when he was at his height, the lights beaming from his head, talking. And then I got to look at his speech and how he played with the words. At first, it was a bland sentence. Do what you can for your country. Don't ask your country to do things for you. And it was so bland. And then he worked with that sentence. Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. And I saw the power in his words. Came right back to the convent, got a Blue Horse 3-punch spiral notebook from the closet for supplies, and started a journal.
And gave it a title page and everything, didn't you?
A title page and everything. And privacy. The Journal of Sister Louis Augusta.
Right. Now, spiritual memoirs have such a strong and lovely tradition, and there's so many, from St. Augustine onward. And
he was the first, and he was the first to use the pronoun I. They never used the pronoun I. They'd say we and the royal we and all these we's. But he said I, and it was personal, yeah.
And so do you. I mean, and you have, you know, this familiar outline, the foundation of faith, the formation, the test of faith, and continuing spiritual progress. So in that way, they offer encouragement to readers, I think, and lead them to think about their own lives.
And you see how faith is such an evolving, growing thing. So faith then in the convent before Vatican II meant keeping the rule, praying together at the designated times, trying to do everything you did, the most ordinary tasks from mopping a floor, teaching kids, with love for God, and that every act that you did was equally pleasing to God. That because you're doing it out of obedience as a nun, that blessed everything. And so it takes time to see and to grow into. Not every act is equal. All acts should be done with love. But when there are crying needs in society and people are suffering, to get engaged in that is not the same as just doing an ordinary task like washing the dishes. Everything's important. So it was that awakening to justice, and not just practicing charity to the people around you or being pious and praying that God would solve the problems of the world and help the suffering people, but that prayer and faith ignites us to roll up our sleeves and be engaged. The pious way that you talk about it is to be the hands of Christ, to be the eyes of Christ in the world, embodied, mm-hmm. incarnate. But it was that waking up. I had to wake up to that because the whole first part of my life as a nun was being charitable to people around me. And I didn't get the thing of that we need to be engaged in social justice. And here I was living in the suburbs of New Orleans. We had 10 major housing projects.
Right.
African-American people struggling against poverty and racism, redlining in the banks, police beating them up, all these things. But it could have been on Mars because mm-hmm. I was in a separate bubble. So I had to break out. And that's grace. It's grace that wakes us up.
Well, it's so interesting because we think of you as so engaged and yeah. we think of you as such an activist. And here you are coming along like everybody else waiting
yeah.
to wake up.
Amazing, huh?
And you even met Martin Luther King in the airport once.
And he was so tired, poor baby. I mean, you know, I realized once I knew his life that he was in that Chicago airport and O'Hare airport because he was leaving that suburb in Cicero,
mm-hmm.
where they had tried to bring the civil rights movement to a white suburban neighborhood. They were marching and they were spit on. They had bricks thrown at them. And it was horrible. It was a terrible, terrible experience. And I realized then when I was getting my ticket there at O'Hare, and I looked behind me in line, I said, that's Martin Luther King. Now, I wasn't doing beans to help in the civil rights movement. But I'd heard of him and I admired him because he based everything on the Christian gospel of love that we'll never return violence for violence. I mean, the first one I had known to really do that.
Right.
And there he was standing in line. And I looked back. So I looked again and then I went to him and I was still in the habit in those days. And I said, Are you Dr. Martin Luther King? He said, yeah, and he kind of just looked so tired. Put his hand out, and I took it. He said, pray for us, sister. Pray for us. And I went back and got in line. I mean, and I always remember that. And then you see pictures of him in airports. He was so tired.
Because there was so much
infighting, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he even went back to Memphis to support the sanitation workers there because violence had erupted on the march and he was going back to do the march again, to do it in a nonviolent way. And all the sanitation workers were asking for was like to have a coffee break, working on the back of these garbage trucks and all, and to have like a minimum increase in the pitiful salary they
right.
got. Holding those signs, I am a man. He's in solidarity with them. Violence broke out on the first one. And he knew that there were threats against him, that someone was lurking and wanted to kill him. And that's when he gave the talk, I've been to the mountaintop. I would like to have a long life. But mm-hmm. he gave his life. Now that, to me, is the heart of what the Jesus love is. You give your life and give it for something bigger than yourself and let the consequences be then what they will. You don't seek death, but because you're in solidarity with people,
mm-hmm.
it happens to you too. It's happened to Jesus.
Were you surprised as you wrote about your own life? I mean,
it's full of surprises. You get humbler and humbler as you write.
You get humbler and humbler as you get older,
so
too.
Arrogant. You know, in my reputation in the community, there goes Helen, firm feet firmly planted midair. I would have all these ideas of how we could get the youth for Christ. We'd have a boot camp out in the woods, boot camp for Jesus. Because
yep.
somebody had given us land in Osaka, Mississippi. No buildings, no running water, no nothing. So we have the meeting with the sisters, and here's where the wisdom of the community comes in. This is why it's good to belong to the sisterhood. I would be nothing without the sisterhood. So we have this meeting, of this idea, this boot camp for Jesus for young people. And they go, well, Helen, any buildings? No, we're going to build the buildings. Well, you got water? Well, no, we're going to get us a well. I mean, in just one question after another. I mean, it was dead in the water within the first 15 seconds. But then they're so kind. You know, I met with the leadership, and they just said, well, that didn't work out too well. Maybe Hope House. Because the most telling thing that happened in the critique of the sisters is one sister stood up, and she'd always kind of been my nemesis or the one who critiqued me. And she said, "Now, Helen, you say you want to train young people to be people of justice for the poor. You got them out in the woods. Helen, you don't have any experience yourself in being with poor people. Don't you think you ought to go?"
Hold your feet to the fire. Yeah.
It was so true. It was a devastating truth, and I knew it. So then when I met with our leadership, God bless them, they just said, "Maybe you could go to Hope House." So there's something already established. Laurie Schaff had begun it like in 1969 or 70. And the humbling part is you realize a lot of people had awakened far before you and were already doing it. And so I go to Hope House there in Irish Channel,
yep.
St. Thomas Housing Projects, only white people among the people there with the sisters who already had been there serving. I wasn't afraid at all in St. Thomas. And all the kids would call any white person they saw, "Sister, hey, sister." Even when the brothers came, So there's Joe Porter with a big beard, and he's walking. He goes, "Sister." He goes, "Look, I'm a brother. I'm not a sister. See the beard." And they go, "Sister, brother."
Whatever.
Because those are the only white people they knew.
That was the beginning of so much for you.
Oh, yeah.
Hope House.
And African American people became my teachers. See, I awakened to privilege. I didn't know. When you're privileged, you're around other people just like you. It's like fish swimming in a school. It's like everybody's like this, right? Everybody's got health care. Everybody has a good education. And then you come upon people struggling with the most basic welfare checks. Terrible public education. Coming into the adult learning center, this kid who had been a junior in a public school, going to help him get his GED, and he couldn't read a third grade reader. And it threw me back St. Joseph Academy, Baton Rouge. Dominican College, then getting my master's in religious ed. All the education I got, what education does, it helps you know what your identity is, what your gifts are, so you can be an agent in the world. You're not a passive little flotsam and jetsam floating on the water at the prey of whatever happens. I awakened to all these things. And what I began to realize was, hey, she's a nun. She's really virtuous and stuff. She prays. Ask her to pray for you. She's got special ties to God and all that stuff that goes with being a nun. And people do it with priests, too, at any rate. And I realized I'm not virtuous. I'm protected. I'm cushioned and resourced. And so I haven't been tested. I haven't been thrown into the fire. I haven't been thrown into the currents, you know, that work against you, like to meet racism everywhere you go, to have people look at you or not to let you be part of something. I mean, so they taught me. The people in St. Thomas taught me. And I learned about white privilege. I learned about institutional racism.
Right. And a lot of this book is about that.
Yeah. Well, the last part of the book, St. Thomas, when I'm there at Hope House, all about waking up to that. Mm-hmm. And you know what? I wasn't a bad person. And people who are not aware of white privilege, we're not bad people. Just unaware, because we've never come up against an edge where you could see, wait a minute, look at what I was given. And then you have more of a tendency to judge and blame others because you unconsciously impose on them. Well, why don't they send their kids to school? Don't they know education's the way out of poverty? Why don't they do this? Why don't they do that? And that's just pure judgment that comes out of not being empathetic or even understanding what has gone into intergenerational poverty, one after the other, so you never have a role model.
And not seeing the playing field for what it is. I mean, you know, it's not fair. It's just not fair. Now, one of the things that you write about this book that is very moving is the way you were supported by love in so many important relationships in your life. You write about
friendships.
Your family with such love, yeah. You know, your parents.
Yeah.
You write about Sister Christopher, who yeah. was your good friend for 34 years.
Yes.
And then Father William, a priest from Boston.
Yes.
And those relationships were very important to you.
Yeah.
And challenging to you.
Well, yeah, yeah, yeah. See, intimacy, where people are past with you, they, you know, just the public face, the you out there, but the vulnerable parts, the inner you. And so where, and love gets tested then, because you're going to be faithful to a friend. Like Chris got sick.
Mm-hmm.
She had cancer. And so to be by her side, to see people through, not just when they're sailing on top of the world, but when they're struggling. And like with William, I didn't know he was an alcoholic. I was so naive.
But you learned.
Well, yeah, because you begin to learn the alcoholic behavior. And when I hear stories of people that have had an alcoholic, like a husband or whatever, and they begin to go to Al-Anon, and they begin to be able to sort out the different threads, because you tend to blame yourself. Like, well, I wasn't alert enough, you know, all that. And especially women tend to do that, I think, in relationships with men. I don't want to make a generality about that.
Mm-hmm.
But more and more emerged that he wanted to be so dominant. And then it got to be that he was more possessive. And then it got to be that if I didn't call him at the exact time I was supposed to call him, no matter what was going on in my life, he would be so emotionally upset for days. That you begin to conform your behavior exactly. I can't let him get upset. All those kind of things started happening in the relationship.
And here you go in your full humanity showing us you're just like everybody else.
You know what? In a way, that's really what writing the memoir was. I joined the human race. I joined the human race.
Well, you showed us your way of being human, which is very special. You know,
each have a unique little way of being a prism of humanity, God knows.
Well, read us a little bit from the introduction of this book. I want people to hear your voice.
Now, y'all listening to this, you got to hear this is how I started out in the introduction. What it's always been about for me is the spiritual energy, the power that flows through us, lights us up, and enlivens whatever we touch. For me, that energy has always been connected to God. Call it mystery. Call it grace. Call it the luminous center we touch sometimes and don't know what to call it. But we know that being in its presence fills us with confidence and peace. I learned as a child that I was created to love God with my whole heart and mind and soul and to love my neighbor as myself. And Jesus, God's Son, would show me how to do it. And the goal of it all, to make it through this life, so I could be happy with God forever in heaven. Getting to heaven was really, really big. Catholics call it the beatific vision, seeing God face to face. Wouldn't it be wonderful to love God so much that I wouldn't be selfish ever again or obsess about myself and what I need and what I want and what I feel? Wouldn't it be drop-dead wonderful? A requirement, actually, the dropping dead, to be so free of ego. Just imagine being so on fire with love for God that I could be a martyr and sing and make jokes even while he was torturing me. Like St. Lawrence, well, obviously this is legend, like St. Lawrence on the gridiron being roasted to death and quipping to his executioners, I think I'm done on this side. Time to turn me over. That's what I call spiritual power.
You had fun reading that,
No, it was just, and you know, there's still truth in all that, that the spiritual energy in us to seek truth. Curiosity is a gift of God. Mm-hmm. Einstein one time was told, you are so smart. He said, it's not that I'm so smart. It's just that I'm very, very, very curious.
Yes.
To be curious, to dig into stuff.
Curiosity and goodwill, I think, are the essential
truth. And then the capacity to love widely, not just people like us, but to cross over mm-hmm. to people who are other, people who are different. And instead of just being afraid of them and seeing them as a threat, to love other people widely.
And to learn from them.
And to learn from everyone. I mean, learning from you, this interview. I mean, we learn from everybody.
We do. We're lucky.
But this passion thing, the very opening, the epigraph, is from St. Bonaventure of the book, because it's called River of Fire. Here's the fire
right.
part. Ask not for understanding, ask for the fire. And that's when the heart, when passion, when commitment catches on fire. To me, to see the presence of God in my life, what I point to the most is not feelings come and go, feeling of being close to God or what made me think I believed in God. That is just a big old myth. Feelings come and go, but the commitment that happens in us is like steel, and we can see it in ourselves. I have seen it in myself about the death penalty. It never goes away. So if wishy-washy me that could try everything in the world and dabble in everything could have a firm, steel-like commitment to something, I point to something bigger, mm-hmm. wider, deeper than me that caught a hold of me. Almost like it's the river part, the flow, the wave. Your boat catches a current, and you start following that current, and it carries you.
Carries you where you need to be.
Yeah.
So that's what keeps you going, because these are dark days. These are dispiriting times, you know, the government's calling to reinstitute the federal death penalty. That's got
to
be...
They're calling to execute 5 people.
Right.
And they went through the rostrum, so to speak, and picked out anybody who killed a child. We can go for those 5. Nobody's going to care. But, see, there's nothing darker than going in the execution chamber and mm-hmm. being with a human being who's alive that you've known for over 2 years and watch them be strapped into a chair and electrocuted to death. I've been... to the really dark places where everybody considered this legal. 80% of the American population supported the death penalty when Dead Man Walking came out in 93. And what made it dark was when you see it up close and just how wrong morally it is to take a person and render them defenseless and then purposely kill them, and that it's all legal. The courts have said it's okay. A lot of the churches were saying it was okay. There was a terrible statistic in the mid-80s that the more people went to church, the more they believed in the death penalty.
Wow.
And it was the completely superficial way, bad theology of interpreting the crucifixion of Jesus. And they just said, well, in fact, I talked to a member of the pardon board went before Pat Sonier, the first man I was with on death row. And he said, well, Sister, God's for the death penalty. I said, what? He said, Jesus was executed by the government, and that's what saved us from our sins. So God didn't oppose executions. In fact, the execution of his son is what saved us. Well, just dig behind that. First, what does it make of God, supposedly a loving father, who demands the death of a son in payment because God's divine sense of justice has been offended? What father would do that? Mm. And that same argument happened within the past year in Wyoming. A woman on the Senate. Wyoming's about to repeal the death penalty. They need her vote. She says, I want to keep the death penalty because if Jesus hadn't been executed by the Romans, we wouldn't be saved from our sins.
Whoa.
So look at it. Look at the superficial way. One of the things I came to in this book and why I wanted to talk about getting Jesus right, mm-hmm. getting Christianity right, because it's being so misused. When you have Jeff Sessions, then the Attorney General of the United States, quoting Paul's epistle to the Romans, chapter 13, of why legally when you separate children from their parents, because it's the civil government doing it, that when we obey the civil government, we're obeying God, that it has the authority of God behind it. Christianity is being perverted. It's mm-hmm. the opposite of what Jesus stood for. you see that and you go, how are we going to get this into the discourse to talk to people about what religion, Christianity is really about? Compassion, empathy, loving, forgiving.
Yes.
And you see it being perverted. So part of this book is about getting religion right. And it took me a while.
It did.
To awaken to it.
And I think that's reassuring to a lot of people when they read this book.
That it takes some time.
But you've read and you've studied and you've thought about so many different things. I was so moved to see all the people you mentioned, like Eric Fromm's The Art of Loving. I remember reading that
book. You do.
And J.D. Salinger.
Yeah.
E.E. Cummings. Yeah. Alice Walker. Yeah. Thomas Merton. And writing all along. Well, you talk about that paper you wrote at Divine Words, the Sparrow Song.
Yeah.
Just, it's a wonderful thing to see a woman thinking on paper. You know what I mean? I always love that.
So. I wonder why you like that so much. Woman thinking on paper.
And out loud, too.
And out loud, yeah, and out loud, too. Yes, indeed.
So that's part of the real fun of this book.
Yeah.
You know? We've been talking with Sister Helen Prejean, whose wonderful new book is River of Fire, My Spiritual Journey. Thank you so much.
Susan, I love talking to you. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Excellent. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, Poppy Tooker discusses Ensign's Drag Queen Brunch, Wednesday, September 4th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library. David Shannon discusses Ensign's his new picture book, Mr. Nogginbody Gets a Hammer, Thursday, September 5th at 4:45 at Octavia Books. Nicole Iden, Kelly Harris, and Sky Jackson read their work at the Poetry Buffet, hosted by Gina Ferrara, Saturday, September 7th at 2 at Ladder Library. And coming up later this month, Blue Cypress Books hosts a sneak peek at coming fiction. Jamie Attenberg reads from All This Can Be Yours, due out in November, and Katie Simpson-Smith reads from The Everlasting, which will be coming in March. They'll be reading Thursday, September 19th at 6 at Blue Cypress Books. Letters Read, curated by Nancy Sharon Collins, presents a reading of the letters of the Baroness Pontalba, Wednesday, September 25th at 5:30 at the State Museum, 701 Charters. And Happy Birthday, Mr. Faulkner, runs September 24th through 26th at the Cabildo and the Hotel Peter and Paul. The theme for 2019 is the American experience in literature and life, including a talk by Faulkner biographer Jay Perini. The Big Read author for the event is Tayari Jones, author of An American Marriage. She will appear in conversation with Maurice Carlos Ruffin, author of We Cast a Shadow. The featured Faulkner title this year is The Wild Palms. For more information and complete schedule, go to faulknersociety.org. Don't forget to listen in next Tuesday at 7:44 a.m. during Morning Edition and 5:44 p.m. during All Things Considered for our new series, Thinking Outside the Book. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.